This is a CBC podcast. Take a trip around the world with As It Happens. From the complex headlines of the day to the weird and wacky, As It Happens brings you the story behind the story. Download the podcast at cbc.ca/as it happens.
Hello, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is the Vinyl Cafe. If you've never stood on the side of a river on a sunny afternoon and squinted out at a set of rapids, your pal at your side, both of you pointing at the standing waves and the eddies, shouting at one another over the roar of the river as you pick your route through the rocks. If you've never done that, and then clambered back upriver, up to where you left your canoe resting at the trailhead, your packs already portaged and waiting for you at the bottom. If you've never stood like that at the side of a river, like you were some army general planning some great battle, and plotted your course, and then hop-jumped back along the shore and clambered into your empty canoe, your pal in the bow, you in the stern, are you ready? Go! That flat moment just before the water begins to boil, and then, like a leaf, you're into it, a part of it. If you've never done that, then let me tell you this. Mostly you paddle backwards in white water. It's counterintuitive until you're taught. Beginners want to power their way through. Those who know better, however, slow it down so they can pick their way from one side of the river to the other. So you paddle backwards and set the bow to just the right angle to the current so the river pushes your canoe sideways this way and then that way so the river is doing most of the work. Set the angle, paddle backwards, and follow the dark V's that mark the deep water. And if you do these things more or less right, chances are you'll make it through, as long as making it through is possible. As long as you didn't misjudge things back there when you were standing on the shore shouting at each other over the water's din. If you've never done this, then you don't know how remarkably slowly you can move while everything is moving quickly around you, how much control you can have in the midst of chaos. The dance of a canoe through whitewater is an exhilarating, absorbing, and educating thing. My apologies. It's summer, and all I can think about are canoes. So many summers I've packed up and gone, left the sorry, sticky city behind me to the dip-glide moment of now, just this stroke and the next and the one after the next, and set up camp and sit by the fire and stare at the stars, shiver in the dew, wonder at the moose standing in the water around the bend, the way the smell of wood smoke gets in your hair and on your skin and into your bones, how good it feels to be smoky. You can cross the country in a canoe, one side to the other. It's how it all began here, more or less, with canoes. A boat tough enough to carry you and your pal and your tent and enough supplies for, well, at least a couple of weeks, depending on what kind of voyageur you are. Strong enough and big enough for that, yet light enough to throw on your aching back. A boat that both carries and can be carried. Ugh, to sit in the stern of a full canoe, all that canvas and leather and wanigans, all carefully packed right to the gunnels, so the packs form a flat tabletop between you and your pal in the bow, to sit there resting your legs jauntily on the packs and then to push off. One of the most memorable moments of my life happened in a canoe. I was a counselor at a summer camp. We were all still young and foolish, and often after the kids were asleep, we used to go to town to be young and foolish. We went to the Winsome Inn, and when we went, we always stayed until closing. And on this night, the night that I'm remembering, when we got back to camp, I decided to stay up even longer. As night turned to morning, as the sky began to slip from black to gray, I slipped down to the waterfront and onto the canoe slip. There was fog hanging low over the lake, fog so thick I could barely see the bow of my little boat, a real pea super, they would say. It would have felt close and claustrophobic, even dangerous, if I hadn't known the lake as well as I did, but I knew the lake. So I slipped into my canoe and I slipped off, and once I was into it, once I was good and lost in the morning mist, I stopped paddling and sat there in the arms of it all. The lake, the fog, the morning, floating in a world where there was no here and no there, no up and no down, just floating, my little young and foolish and sleep-deprived self. When suddenly I heard the strangest sound, like a helicopter lifting off, coming closer and closer. I barely had enough time to wonder about it, barely enough time to think before it cleared the fog and passed right over my bow. Not a helicopter. A great blue heron, its great wings flapping. I don't know who was more startled, the bird or the boy. This remnant of the dinosaurs, so close and so ancient all at once. I was never before and haven't been since more a part of the world. These days I do most of my paddling by daylight, and all of it in lakes. My favorite thing is to slip along the shore. If you do that, if you stay very close to the trees, you can create the illusion of great speed. Not as exciting nor as absorbing as white water, but every bit as pleasing. In my life, I have built one canoe and wrapped another around a rock on the Little Nation River. So the ledger is even, Stephen. I'd like to think, however, that I might leave the world with more canoes than I found in it. Today on the show, we're going on a canoe trip. It's canoes from start to finish on the Vinyl Cafe today. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short, but after that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of our latest book. It's called Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. We have a story today from Darren Sleep of Saint-Lazare, Quebec. Dear Stuart, writes Darren. In the latter part of the winter of 2008, I received an unexpected phone call from my parents in New Brunswick. Your mother wants to go canoe camping this summer, my dad said. What do you think about that? Have you called the ambulance, I asked? Maybe she's had a stroke. Generally speaking, my mother is not the outdoor canoe camping, roughing it kind of mother. She's tough enough, all right, but this was not the sort of thing she would normally go for. Apparently she had read a piece in a magazine about a couple of retirees who went canoe camping somewhere, and the image of floating down a gentle river on a lazy afternoon and eating dinner on a riverbank had appealed to her. She had no idea just how thankful we all would be that she followed through on that magazine's advice. When she asked my father if he could think of any couple crazy enough to accompany them on such an adventure, he hesitated only a moment or two before he picked up the phone and called us. My wife and I had recently moved with our two young boys to Montreal, but we'd spent the last decade or so moving throughout Canada in the pursuit of higher education. As an ecologist, camping and canoeing had always been part of my repertoire, so my wife and kids were no strangers to the outdoors. My father knew this well and was counting on the fact that we would have the equipment to make the trip enjoyable. And so, several months later, we found ourselves on the banks of the Salmon River in central New Brunswick. We had borrowed and begged three canoes from friends and family. My mother and father were in one, my older brother and his daughter in another, and my wife, our two boys, and I were in the third. We put in around mid-morning and followed the meanderings of the river for 5 or 6 hours. The weather was perfect, with the late August clouds drifting in and out. The river was low in some places, causing us to get out and pull the boats over shallow, rocky areas. In the deep water, when the children got restless, we grabbed them by their life jackets, threw them overboard, and let them swim with the current. By late afternoon, everyone was tired. We began to look for a place to camp. After a few bends in the river, we spotted a grassy spot where a small stream entered the river. As if an omen, a bald eagle sat by the river's edge, eating his evening catch. At the sight of our flotilla, he took to the air. After tents were raised and dinner was cooked and eaten, we tied ropes to the kids and hauled them through the river's current while they laughed and splashed. In the evening, we sat by the fire and talked for a while before a few black flies and exhaustion drove us into our tents. Dawn revealed a misty morning, damp and chilly, but a hot breakfast of porridge, bacon, eggs, and coffee brightened everyone's spirits. By the time we took to the river, the morning fog was burning off, and the sun was beginning to push through the gray. After 3 or 4 more hours of paddling, we neared the spot where we had stashed a vehicle. My wife and I arrived ahead of the others and began to unload. Most of us were tired and looking forward to getting off the river, but my mother, for reasons known only to her, wanted to press on. She wanted to follow the water a few kilometers further and take out near the town where she grew up. My eldest son, who was 5 at the time, wasn't feeling well and had developed a low-grade fever, so my wife and I were done. My father was needed to drive one of the cars, and my niece was in no mood for paddling. So while the rest of us started carrying equipment up the hill to the cars, my brother agreed to paddle the remaining distance with my mother. It was a short but wonderful canoe trip, and there was already talk of what we would do next time to make it even better. In retrospect, that day and a half on the river was a once-in-a-lifetime event. Much to everyone's great sadness, my brother was diagnosed with a brain tumor about 2 months later. 11 months after that, he passed away. The last few kilometers he paddled with my mother are, for her, a cherished memory. That day on the water is etched in his daughter's mind forever as precious. I've often wondered if events don't conspire at times to give us moments to hang on to when the sadness of life hits. The trip, of course, was not about my brother, but now that he is gone, we look back on photographs of our fondest memory together. The picture of him and his daughter as they paddled in the afternoon sun. The moment we stood on the riverbank eating supper and enjoying each other's company. The way he decided to carry on down the river with Mom when everyone else was too tired or too busy. These are the moments that now define that trip for all of us. There may, of course, be other camping trips, but none will ever be as poignant or as meaningful as that trip on the Salmon River. That story came to us from Darren Sleep of Saint-Lazare, Quebec. Well, I'm Stuart McLean, and this is The Vinyl Cafe, and we're talking about canoes on the show today. Next up, we have a story about a canoe adventure that Dave and Morley took a few years ago. This is The Canoe Trip. So Dave has already started planning next year's wedding anniversary celebration. He's been pawing through the brochures about hiking trips in Banff, boat tours on the Great Lakes, even a train excursion to the north. You get a certificate, he said, when you cross the Arctic Circle. I beg your pardon, said Morley. It's suitable for framing, said Dave. Dave and Morley got married in the summer over 20 years ago, and Dave, you might be surprised to learn, has been planning all of their wedding anniversary celebrations for the last few years. Dave loves to mark each passing year, loves to tell everyone about the longevity of his marriage. It makes Dave feel rejuvenated and hopeful. 20 years, over 20 years, and all is still well. It was this notion that he and Morley have hardly changed, that led Dave to this year's idea. The idea that this summer, he and Morley should spend their anniversary the same way they spent their honeymoon, in a canoe. The first canoe trip since their honeymoon. What do you think, said Dave to Morley as they got ready for bed one night in early June. They had the time. Stephanie would be tree planting. Sam would be at camp. Morley was in her mid-20s that summer when they were married. They had gone to Algonquin Park, and she remembered, the call of the loons and the rippling leaves, and the two of them lying in their sleeping bags outside their tent, staring up at a sky of crowded stars. That would be perfect, said Morley. On their honeymoon, young and fit and with time on their hands, they had spent 6 full days in the park. They settled on 3 days for their return trip. 3 days and 2 nights. The wolf of ambition was not as restless as it was when they were young. Dave found a route they could do in the few days they had. And one night, late in June, he and Morley descended into the basement to look for their camping stuff. Morley sorted through the camping pots and pans. She checked out the propane stove, inspected the backpacks. She headed to the sporting goods store to fill in the holes that 20 years had made in their camping gear. Dave? Well, Dave was in charge of the tent. Their first day in Algonquin Park was gloriously sunny and warm. Dave and Morley paddled gently along the shoreline, talking about the kids and reconnecting with one another. It took them longer to reach their campsite than Dave had predicted. By the time they dragged the canoe up on shore, the sun was dipping and the sky was dusty and orange. They set up camp. Morley pulled the camping pots from the canoe and Dave headed over to the edge of the clearing to put up the tent. He'd packed the same 2-man tent they had used all those years ago. Not without checking it out. Checking it out included pulling the tent from the bag, confirming that there were still poles and pegs, that the fly was there too. Checking it out did not, however, include unfolding the nylon tent or fitting the poles together, or doing a trial run by putting the tent up in the backyard. If he had done that, Dave would have realized that even that miracle fiber nylon changes over 20 years. In the 45 minutes that it took Dave to wrestle their tent up, he had plenty of time to take in the rotting seams, the cracked fabric, and the rusty zippers. Crouching inside to unroll the mats and put down the sleeping bags, he watched the last rays of the sun seep through the yawning gaps of their only shelter. Supper that night was reconstituted freeze-dried chili. While it was cooking, Dave popped some freeze-dried turkey hash into his mouth. "You're supposed to add hot water to that," said Morley. "I know," said Dave, who was chewing energetically. "But you'd be surprised how good it is like this." At the end of the meal, Dave gathered all their food up and put it into an old green canvas backpack, a woods tripper. And then he tied a rope around the top of the pack and he flung the rope over a high branch of a maple tree some distance from their tent and then he hauled the food up high into the air. There, he said, if the bears want a snack, they'll have to do a bit of climbing. Morley fell asleep almost immediately. Dave lay there grateful that she was so exhausted she didn't notice the mosquitoes that were moving in and out of the zipped-up tent with impunity. And then Dave fell asleep too. Next thing Dave knew, Galway the cat was on his bed. She'd been doing this a lot lately, climbing up there before the alarm and rubbing around the pillow and tickling Dave with her whiskers. Don't get ahead of me. Dave knew what she wanted. She wanted Dave to feed her. And he half thought of batting her away. But it was probably time to get up anyway, so Dave said, "Okay, Galway," and he opened his eyes. Now, like many people, Dave has in idle moments wondered how he might react if he ever found himself in the thick of a crisis. If he was, say, a customer at a bank during a holdup or a hostage in a hostage taking. Largely, he wonders about these things in bed at night. Lies in the darkness, working out the steps he'd take if his parachute was twisted when it opened. Not that he has any plans of jumping out of a plane. But these are important questions, and they're things that occupy Dave's mind when sleep won't. He's considered many things, worked through many scenarios, though never what he would do or should do if he woke up in a tent eyeball to eyeball with a skunk. He said, "Okay, Galway," and he opened his eyes. And there was a beat of silence and then another. And what he did was he gasped and he sat bolt upright. The skunk scampered to the bottom of his sleeping bag. And lifted his tail. And stood there with his eyes locked on Dave's. Dave tried to look as friendly as he could. He smiled and nodded. The skunk twitched its tail. Dave froze. Skunk, which was outside of the sleeping bag, was actually standing on Dave's feet, which were inside the bag. Skunk seemed undecided. And the two of them stared at each other for what felt like a long time. And actually was a long time, given the circumstances. 5 minutes passed. And during those 5 minutes, Dave had only one thought. Don't move your feet. Morley was still asleep. 5 minutes passed, though it felt much longer than 5 minutes. And then the skunk, who seemed to have taken Dave's smile as an invitation to stay a while, sat down. Began to snore. Then it got up again and ambled over to Morley's backpack. Bag was lying in the corner of the tent and the zipper was open. And Dave watched as the skunk poked its nose into the pack. And that's when the squirrel leapt out. Blur of brown fur catapulted across the tent. And both the skunk and Dave jumped simultaneously. The skunk landed in Dave's lap. And Dave screamed, and Morley, who was still asleep, more or less, shouted. And then there was a flurry of flying fur and the sound of nylon ripping, and Morley and Dave burst from the tent, gasping for breath. And as they stood there, beside what was left of their tent, Dave glanced at his watch. 10:30. Couldn't be. "Oh my God," he said, "hurry up, hurry up. We gotta pack up," he said, "pack up, pack up. We gotta get going or we won't make it to the next campsite before dark." 20 minutes later, they were floating along the shoreline again. By 12:30, Morley had gone just about as far as she could go without food. They decided to have a picnic on the water. Now, at just about that time, Nellie and Ken Chapman were getting ready to take a break, too. Nellie and Ken were paddling down the same shoreline that Morley and Dave had left behind. And at just about that time, Nellie and Ken spotted the campsite that Dave and Morley had vacated just a few hours earlier. It wasn't the easy access or the small clearing that drew their attention. What caught Nellie and Ken's attention was the large green backpack hanging from the branch of the tree. What do you mean you forgot the food? Said Morley. Weakly. She wasn't as angry as you might imagine. Her right eye was swelling from a mosquito bite and her back ached. Morley felt too beaten up, too weak, and too hungry to be angry. We'll go back and get it, said Dave, feathering his paddle in the water. It'll only take a few hours. But they couldn't go back and get it. They were supposed to pick Sam up the following afternoon at 5. They were 2 days paddle away from the park entrance, from their car, from a telephone, from any way to reach their son. Morley could imagine the scene in her mind's eye, a deserted camp parking lot. Sam standing small and alone, waiting sadly for the parents who had clearly forgotten him. Just paddle, she said, just paddle. As luck would have it, they were not entirely without food. After half an hour of paddling, Morley remembered that she had shoved some snacks into her pack and had forgotten to move them into the food bag the night before. There was a small Swiss chocolate bar, 2 packs of sugarless gum, and a 1-pound bag of red licorice. Dave watched in amazement as Morley pulled it from her knapsack. No wonder there was so much activity in their tent. He didn't say that. After the licorice stopped, Morley and Dave fell into a rhythm, their strokes steady and even. Across the lake, Dave spotted a young couple paddling. They were the only people they had seen since entering the park. I wonder if they're on their honeymoon, said Dave. If they get a little closer, said Morley, I have some advice I'd like to give them. By the late afternoon, they'd entered a river. They were supposed to portage past a set of rapids and continue for another mile to that night's campsite. Dave maneuvered over to the left side of the river. Where's the portage? Said Morley. Should have been right there. Dave was gesturing at the riverbank. It was a stretch of wet marsh, more a bayou than a bank. They could hear the rapids. They were going to have to get out of the river, portage trail or no portage trail. Dave wedged the canoe between 2 fallen logs, as close to dry land as he could, and then he and Morley jumped out into the knee-deep water. They muscled the boat towards the shore. And when they got to higher ground, Dave looked at Morley, who was sitting in the dirt, her back against the side of the canoe. Her hair was tangled and matted and sticking out at odd angles. She was gritty and sweaty, her face sunburned and spotty. What? Said Morley. I didn't say anything, said Dave. They set off down the path with the canoe hoisted over their heads. As they trudged along, the sun began to dip below the trees. Night was settling on the forest path. Dave took the lantern and held it in his teeth. And the two of them lurched along like 2 soaked donkeys. The canoe balanced awkwardly over their head. Morley was up to her ankles in mud, and she was sinking deeper with each step. Pretty soon she was wet up to her thighs, covered in muck and mosquito bites. She could only see out of one eye. Her arms ached and her head hurt. Before long, the mud was sloshing around her knees, and Morley was thinking that she was about as uncomfortable as a person could be. Unfortunately, she was wrong. A minute later, her foot settled deep into the oozing, slippery muck. When she pulled it out, her shoe was missing. I don't have to tell those of you who are married that during a marriage, things get said. During a marriage, certain things a self-respecting growing up might not admit to, well, let's be honest, certain angry things do get said. And after 20 years of marriage, 20 years of careers and child rearing, 20 years of homemaking and renovations, 20 years of car trips and school trips, 20 years of birthday parties and Christmas turkeys. Well, a lot of these certain things get said. In fact, so many of these certain things have been said in Dave and Morley's household that, quite frankly, Dave thought he'd heard about every certain thing that Morley would ever say. Unfortunately, he was wrong. He prayed it was just the licorice talking. The sun had completely disappeared by the time Morley and Dave stumbled into the clearing at the end of the portage trail. When they got there, the lantern battery gave up. Light dimmed and flickered out. Dave said, "I guess this is the end of the road for us." Morley said, "You can say that again." "I meant for tonight," said Dave. They settled their canoe into some muddy ground beside the river. Dave put Morley's soggy sleeping bag in the bottom and he crawled in. He had his feet under one seat and was leaning against the other. Morley got into the canoe and sat between Dave's legs. She covered herself with a rubber ground sheet. It started to drizzle. Eventually, somehow, who can explain these things, Morley fell asleep. Not long after, she woke up with Dave nudging her. "Wake up," he said. Morley opened her eyes, and when she did, the sky was glowing. There were flashing streaks of pale blue and green light filling the sky like sheet lightning. It looked as if someone had draped the horizon with some sort of huge shimmering veil. It was the Northern Lights. "Remember," said Dave. They had seen them on their honeymoon, too. Dave and Morley sat in the middle of that canoe in the middle of that night under the most spectacular of light shows, the Aurora Borealis. Dave's arms were around Morley, and she felt remarkably warm, cozy even, and comfortable. She moved her head onto her husband's chest. She heard his heart slowing down, beating a gentle, steady rhythm beneath his sweater. A loon called out across the water, and the lights continued to dance. Morley sighed. "I guess," said Dave, "some things don't change after 20 years. "No," said Morley. I mean, yes. She sounded surprisingly content. "I guess they don't," she said. Like I said at the beginning, Dave has started planning next year's anniversary already. He hasn't given up on the idea of taking another canoe trip sometime. But next year, he's thinking he'll try something different. He's been looking at a brochure for a place called the Albion Resort. Brochure is pretty slick. It says, "The inn where we take care of everything." After 20 years of marriage, Dave knows good advice when he reads it. Thank you very much. Thank you. That was the story we call the canoe trip. That's about all the time we have for today's show. Before we go, I should remind you about the Vinyl Cafe Arthur Awards, because nominations for the 2013 awards are closing soon. The Arthur Awards, as you know, are the awards we hand out every Thanksgiving weekend, the awards that recognize people for everyday things that too often go unrewarded. These are the awards where you get to choose both who wins and why, because you can choose both the nominees and the categories. The categories can be informed by your sense of the world. If you're driven by a sense of irony, go ahead and nominate someone ironically or whimsically or earnestly, whatever's your pleasure. You can nominate anyone for anything, big or small, and you can send your nominations to The Arthurs, and that's all one word, The Arthurs at cbc.ca, or you can mail them to us, and if you get a pen, I'll give you the mailing address. Are you ready? If you want to mail them to us, you can mail your nominations to us at The Arthurs, care of The Vinyl Cafe, CBC Radio, P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, and the postal code is M5W1E6. We'll be presenting Arthur Award winners with their awards right here on the radio on Thanksgiving weekend, and that's Canadian Thanksgiving. And to our American friends listening, you can look that up. It's October up here. Okay, that really is all the time we have for today's show. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Greg DeClute is the recording engineer. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton, and I'm Stuart McLean. So long for now.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.